Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and last week we got the news from the Census Bureau that New York has the widest gap in America between rich and poor. The report I read in the Times said in most places that gap is caused by the extreme poverty in the region, but in New York it's thanks to the extreme wealth at the top end. So it's not so bad, right? Well, wrong, I'm guessing my next guest would say. Robert Franks is an economics professor at Cornell and the author of several books, including a brand new one called Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class, in which he lays out the case for why earning more money doesn't necessarily lead to economic security and why taxing spending, not income, would be better for everyone, in his opinion. Professor Frank, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me on, Brian.
And some of you may know he's also an economics columnist in the business section of the Sunday New York Times. But we should clarify that you are Professor Robert H. Frank, with two books out this summer, Falling Behind and The Economic Naturalist, not Robert Frank of The Wall Street Journal, who we also had on the show this summer to talk about his book, Richistan. So you both deal with issues of wealth. Does it get confusing?
It has, really. We've each gotten emails intended for the other. The Times ran an article back in January saying, if you want a book for this or for that, try a book by Robert Frank, just because we both had one coming out at the same time on the same subject.
Yeah, chances are it would address your interest. So were you surprised by these new census figures that widening gap between rich and poor is not new, but is there something new about it?
No, I don't think there's anything really new there, Brian. It's been going on since at least the early 70s. This pattern that we've seen in the last three decades is really quite different from what we had right after World War II. Those three decades, everyone's income up and down the ladder, those incomes were growing at about 3% a year. The rich, if anything, were seeing their incomes grow a little bit more slowly. All that changed suddenly around the mid or early 70s. Virtually all the income growth has gone to people at the top since then. And so these latest New York figures really are just a resumption of the trend that was interrupted very briefly in the months after 2001 9/11 episode. There was a little bit of a downturn in the trajectory of the top earners, but that's picked up. You know, it's really just a continuation.
So you use these two thought experiments to open your discussion in the book for why more money isn't necessarily good in and of itself. So let's try it out with our listeners. Which world would you rather live in, people? World A, in which you live in a 4,000-square-foot house, but others live in a 6,000-square-foot house, or World B, in which you live in a 3,000-square-foot house, but others live in a 2,000-square-foot house? So again, your house could either be 4,000 square feet with others living in a 6,000, or yours could be smaller, 3,000 square feet, but others live even smaller than you, 2,000 square feet. So think about that for a minute. You can even call in on it if you want at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Professor Frank, which did you think people would pick and why?
Well, the economics profession, if you look at the models we use, there's a clear prediction. It's just a no-brainer thought experiment. Everybody would pick World A, where they'd have a 4,000-square-foot house, rather than World B, where it would be only 3,000 square feet. The idea in the economic models we all use is that utility or satisfaction depends only on your absolute level of consumption. In fact, though, when you put that question to people, they don't seem to think it's a particularly easy question to answer. They think about it. But more than half usually say they'd end up picking World B, where they'd have a 3,000-square-foot house, others a 2,000-square-foot house. I'd be curious to hear how you thought about the choice when you thought about it, not particularly which one you would have chosen, but what were the factors you thought about when you were thinking about which one you chose?
Me? You're asking me?
Yeah, you.
Just
out of curiosity.
Oh, well, I'll be completely honest with you. My reaction was immediately that I would want to live in the bigger square footage, regardless of anyone else, and that I was wondering if you were playing some kind of political trick by laying out the other option and maybe easily concluding that people are so status conscious that they would actually rather live in a smaller space themselves if they were able to get more status compared to other people living in even a smaller space. In other words, I guess my intuition is that people would choose the larger space.
Yeah, and some people do. There isn't a wrong answer here, but I think it's interesting how people think about it. I know most people, I don't, I bet you don't, most people don't think of themselves as particularly status conscious. And if you think about it as a thought experiment directed at that desire, then I think the inclination is to say, well, I don't care about status. I'll pick the 4,000-square-foot house.
Now, here's somebody calling in to say they would pick the 3,000-square-foot house, and it's Steve in Greenwood Lake. Steve, you're on WNYC.
How are you doing? I have a 1,450-square-foot house, so I'd take the 3,000-square-foot house. And everybody would have to come over to my house because I'd have all the extra room, so I'd save on gas. You know, I'd have the pool table and the projection TV screen because I'd have room for it.
See, but an economist would probably say, but wait, then you're going to have to spend on throwing all the parties.
No, everybody brings the chips and the, whatever else. And, you know, I just sit here and have the space.
All right, it's BYO. It's Steve's in Greenwood Lake. Steve, thank you very much. Common answer, Professor Frank?
Yeah, that's not unusual. Again, most people do pick the relatively big house, the absolutely smaller one.
They do. So this experiment has been done.
Yeah, no, I've put this question to lots of people, and it's not a really one-sided split, but there's a slight balance in favor of people picking the 3,000-square-foot house.
Here's another one. Tom in Long Valley, you'd also pick the 3,000-square-foot house?
Oh, yeah, I would. And the reasoning for that would be, I guess, if you're going to measure your success or your standard of living, it's got to be against others, and if you're in a 3,000-square-foot house and they're in a 2,000, obviously you're doing well.
But, Tom, wouldn't you rather have the extra 1,000 square feet to live in than the status?
If everyone else is living in a 6,000-square-foot house, I would assume I'm not doing as well, and therefore that's why I would choose 3,000.
But you're saying the status is really more important to you than the space.
Well, status or trying to judge how successful you are, I guess that's the same thing. I would say it's more important than the extra 1,000 square feet.
Tom, thank you very much. Well, he was very honest, Professor.
I would say you're pushing Tom to an interpretation of his choice that I don't think most people feel perfectly comfortable with. He was candid about it. But when I think about the two, it's not primarily, I think I'd pick the 3,000-square-foot house, but not really because I would want to lord having a bigger house over anyone or would want to feel pumped up from the high status. Uh-huh. No, it's that if you're in a relatively cheap house in the environment you live in, that determines many things about your life. I mean, if you want to send your kids to a good school, what's true about schools and houses in this country is that the houses that are below average in price, the children who live in those houses go to below average schools,
right,
and vice versa.
And I know that's central to your book and your policy recommendations.
It's really a totally normal desire for a parent to want his or her children to go to the best schools possible, and that means buying the highest price house you can in your area. That's just the link that we observe between school quality and house prices. So,
Cornell economist Robert Frank, my guest on WNYC, his new book, Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. And I don't want to give short shrift to the serious policy analysis and recommendations that you make in your book. But briefly, I want to go to part two of this thought experiment, which is a similar kind of comparison. In this case, World A, where you get 4 weeks vacation, but others get 6 weeks, or World B, where you get 2 weeks vacation, but others get one. So listeners, think about that. And I want to cut to the chase on this, Professor Frank, and you say that it comes out the opposite of the housing question.
That's right. Here, Brian, when you put that question to people, again, there's no right answer, but you get a preponderance of people saying they'd pick the world where they had 4 weeks of vacation each year, even though everyone else there had six. It's true they would have relatively low vacation time, but in the world where they had 2 weeks of vacation time, everyone else had one, That's half as much vacation time, and that's going to hurt you more than the feeling that, wow, I'm doing better than everyone else on vacation time. So some things, the thought experiments seem to illustrate, some things have a more important role for context to play when we're thinking about is this good or bad. So in vacation time, it's more the absolute vacation time you look at. With housing, really there's a big role for context there. Is my house okay? I was a Peace Corps volunteer. I lived in a two-room house with a grass roof, no electricity, no plumbing. It was a fabulous house in Nepal, in the rural village where I lived. None of the other teachers had a house even as nice as the house I lived in. I never for a moment experienced it as an unsatisfactory house, but somebody in the U.S. in a house like that, just his kids wouldn't want their friends to know where they live. They would be ashamed, and it wouldn't be abnormal to have that reaction. It's just this environment's very different, and the context that we live in defines a standard that you'd be so far below that it just wouldn't be suitable.
So these are all based around the idea of relative wealth or relative poverty. But how do we get from that to someone in the middle class losing ground even while making more money, as you posit in the book?
People in the middle are making more than they were 30 years ago, albeit not much more. There's been very little growth, actually, by historical standards for the person in the middle. What's happened is that people in the middle are spending more. So if you look at the median new house built in the U.S., it's about 30% larger than the median new house 30 years ago. If you want to send your children to the a school of average quality, you've got to match what your neighbors are spending on housing. And so if you're not earning much more, the task of carrying a mortgage on a house that's 30% bigger and more expensive for other reasons is just a much bigger burden on you financially than the burden carried by the middle-income family 30 years ago. You've got to borrow more, you're saving less, you're working longer hours, you've got to commute a longer distance if you can't afford to live where you want to live. You move further out to help keep your payments lower. It's a much bigger strain now for the middle-income family to satisfy the goal of getting its children into an average school.
Because going back to the experiment and the relationship between home sizes and decent school districts in the real world, you're saying as the rich have gotten richer, and therefore keeping up with the Joneses requires keeping up with a higher and higher standard of living, that status point is going up faster than the average income for a middle wage earner.
That's right. Now, it's not that the people in the middle are trying to keep up with Bill Gates and his 45,000 square foot mansion. That's not their goal. Nobody even thinks about that. What happens, though, is that all the income gains having been concentrated at the top, the people at the top are building bigger houses. That's totally normal. That's what everyone does when they get more money. People in the middle aren't envious. There's no evidence of that. They like the pictures of the mansions. They go buy magazines with spreads on them. What happens, though, is that the people just below the top do seem to be influenced by the larger mansions at the top. Maybe now it's the custom in their circle to have their daughter's wedding reception in the home. So the people just below the top, they feel they need to build bigger too now. And the people just below them, they rub elbows with the people just below the top. And so their frame of reference gets shifted too. It's a cascade that goes one step at a time all the way down to the family in the middle and even beyond the middle. So you're not trying to keep up with the rich, but it was the spending of the rich that launched that mm-hmm. cascade.
Susan in Greenwich, you're on WNYC. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I feel like since I'm from Greenwich, I'm going to be a different example. I don't know. I don't live in a big house. I live in a little house. But it's kind of, I mean, I definitely would want to live in a more even neighborhood because, you know, in Greenwich we have like these huge houses and everybody hates them. I don't desire to live in the McMansion, really. Mm-hmm. They're terrible. So, and it's sort of, it kind of makes the neighborhood, or and it's sort of an analogy about the country, that if everybody isn't sort of more even, it's not as nice a place to live.
There is some evidence that in places where the spread between rich and poor isn't as big, and rich and middle isn't as big as it is here, people are happier, not just the people in the middle, but also the rich.
Kay in New Brunswick. You're on WNYC with Robert Frank. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I was wondering, contrary to your last caller, I really feel that you would see a difference if you took gender into consideration. Have you taken gender into consideration? Because I feel my immediate answer to the question is I want the bigger house. You know, I have kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want the space. And I would also appreciate the ability to foster more of a relationship with my extended family. Also, though, too, would you take into consideration the, you know, different groups, the different demographics
yeah.
that also involve social, economic, and racial.
Right. And so you're saying, for one thing, you think women are just more practical than men.
Especially
women with kids. Professor Frank, did you break out anything demographically in that study?
I don't have numbers to report, but I didn't notice any gender difference in the responses, just from an eyeball perspective. And it would be typically the women who would be more directly focused on where the kids are going to school. And so I think the people who think through the choice of where you want to be on the relative scale in practical terms and focus on that issue of where your kids are going to end up going to school in that society, I think my prediction would be that the women would be more likely to choose the 3,000-square-foot house than the 4,000-square-foot one. You know, not all women, of course. And anyway, 3,000 square feet is a pretty big house. By world standards, it's a mansion. If my house may be almost that big. If my village friends from Nepal long ago saw my house today, they would think I'd totally taken leave of my senses.
Right.
So it's not really a small house we're talking about.
By New York City standards, it's a mansion, too.
Yes, exactly.
We will continue in a minute with Robert H. Frank, economist at Cornell, author now of Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. And we will hear his proposal for overhauling the tax code, having us taxed based on something other than income, and why he thinks that might change many things for the better for middle-income earners in the United States. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and remember, you can subscribe for free to our Brian Lehrer Show daily podcast. Every day we pick one segment from the program for your iPod or MP3. To sign up for our free daily podcast, just go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. We continue with Cornell economics professor Robert H. Frank. His new book is called Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. And let's go on to your tax proposals, because you suggest that that we go from taxing income to taxing something else. Lay it out.
Okay, what's happening is that all the income gains, as we discussed in the earlier segment, are going to people at the very top of the income ladder. They've gained enormously since the mid-70s. The top 1% now are earning about three times as much as they were then. If you go higher up, it's even more. And so their natural response has been to spend more. That creates a cascade of spending that goes down the income ladder that's made things tougher on people in the middle. At the same time, we've got massive federal budget deficits. We've been unable to pay our bills. We have negative savings. The last 2 years running, the country has been spending more in total than it's been earning. You can't keep that up, obviously, forever. So what to do here? The proposal I offer in Falling Behind is to scrap the income tax altogether. In its place, adopt a progressive consumption tax. And it would be a fairly simple modification, actually, of the existing tax system. What we would do is report our incomes to the IRS just as we do now. Then we would document how much we saved during the year. We already know how to do that for 401k retirement programs and other similar ones that help us put retirement savings away tax-free. And then the difference between the income you report and this year's savings that you report, well, that's how much you spent this year. We don't have to keep track of receipts and add it all up. It's just the difference between income, which we already know how to report, savings, which we're already reporting. That difference is how much you spent. And then the tax is levied on that amount minus a large standard deduction, let's say $7,500 for each person, a family of four, wouldn't pay any tax at all on the first $30,000. So then the tax starts small. If you're a low spender, you pay at a very low rate for each dollar you spend, and it gradually escalates, and can escalate quite sharply at the top. So if you're spending $4 million a year already, to spend one more dollar, you might have to pay an extra $2 in consumption tax. And the effect of a tax like that would be to solve two problems for us. It would raise revenue for the things we can't afford to do now. We've been cutting back on a lot of very important government spending categories the last couple of years. I'll mention one. The Bush administration, citing federal budget deficits and the need to do something about them, cut back the Energy Department's program for rounding up loosely guarded nuclear materials in the former Soviet Union. These are materials terrorists are trying to acquire. They're guarded by soldiers who aren't paid regularly, who drink a lot, who don't have big fences around their installations. We really ought to round those materials up and get them under secure lock and key as quickly as possible. We're cutting back on our efforts to do that because we have budget deficits. So the tax would help pay for such things as that. At the same time, if you're a high spender, it would give you a very different incentive about where to send the next dollars. I can either save them, put them in my investment account, and they'll be tax-free, or I can build another wing on the mansion. But if I do that, I'll have to pay, if I'm a really big spender, 200% beyond the actual cost of constructing the wing on the mansion.
So if the you're saying if the tax code created an incentive to save more and spend less, even for wealthier people, you'd wind up kind of slowing this consumption arms race, which
exactly.
would make the middle income earners' incomes go further toward the things that they really need.
Bingo. That's I couldn't have put it any better.
So why don't we have that kind of system?
You know, it's not out of the question. Sam Nunn and Pete Domenici proposed a tax like this in 1995. It never made it onto the agenda for a vote because there were other budget squabbles that got in the way. I wrote a piece in 1997 advocating this tax. Shortly after it was published, I got a nice letter from Milton Friedman, the late Nobel Prize conservative economist from the University of Chicago. He enclosed an article he himself had written and published in 1943 in the American Economic Review proposing exactly the same tax as the most efficient way to raise revenue for the war effort.
So why are you and Milton Friedman on the same side? I mean, I always thought progressives dislike taxing consumption because the lower your income, the more of it you have to spend. Therefore, the tax is regressive. I realize you're talking about a progressive version of it.
Exactly.
But the one we're likely to hear propose a consumption tax in the Republican debate tonight is Mike Huckabee, very conservative governor of
Arkansas. That's a great question. The conservatives like consumption taxes. What they would really like to have is a flat tax. That's the one Steve Forbes proposed during his presidential campaign.
But that's still an income tax.
Which is a sales tax. No, that's a sales tax.
Okay.
In effect, it's a value-added tax. And really, it's a horribly regressive tax for just the reasons you mentioned, because the middle-income and low-income families spend virtually all their incomes. They'd be paying tax on a much higher share of their economic throughput than a rich family would, because the rich families manage to save much more. It's a totally different ball game if you have a progressive consumption tax. That's a tax you can make just as progressive as you choose. So there's really not the traditional liberal objection to a sales tax. On the other hand, it does reward saving and investment. It promotes economic growth. Those are the things the conservatives are looking to promote with their sales tax. So this would do so one step better than a flat tax. So it's really, I think this is where we have to go if we're looking for a compromise. It's very hard to change tax policy.
Yeah.
You got all the winners, all the losers.
All the vested interests.
All the vested interests line up. It's very difficult to change. So I think we're going to have to look for a proposal that not only achieves the policy aims we want, but that's going to attract the widest mix of different political viewpoints to support it. And I think that's this tax here.
So here's an investment banker calling to take issue with this idea. Mike in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi,
yeah,
Mike.
I'm actually not so much taking issue as I'd like to ask Professor Frank how you avoid the problem which has developed both in Poland, that I know quite well, where we've done tried to do some venture investing, and also in Israel. What happens is that everybody works off the books. And so when you build that enlargement on your house, you get day laborers, and they get paid off the books. And there's this enormous underground economy of building supplies and building materials. And what happens is you end up with all of these leakages, and the government never gets its money.
That's really interesting. So rather than trying to keep your income off the books, which people might have incentive to do now, you try to keep your spending off the books. Have you considered that, Professor Frank?
Yeah, that's the problem. If you would move to a national sales tax, which is what the conservatives have been proposing, then you have exactly that worry. If you move to a progressive consumption tax of the sort I'm proposing, then
which
there's
is really
not that
income-based.
Worry at all. You can pay all the day laborers you want off the books. What you're going to pay tax on has nothing to do with what you pay them. What you're going to pay tax on is the difference between the income figure you report to the IRS. You know, we've got to monitor you there and make sure you don't hide that. And the savings you report. You got to put that into a registered account, much as you would for 401k.
Right.
But those are the two numbers.
Right. The real incentive.
You want to go to the underground economy, it's not going to help you with those numbers.
The real incentive there is to save, because it's the money that you don't spend or save that becomes tax exempt. Why wouldn't that slow economic growth? Because, you know, people's spending helps to fuel economic growth.
Okay, that's a good question. People are worried that if consumption goes down, which would be one of the aims of this tax, why doesn't that cause a recession? What we need is spending. We don't need consumption spending as opposed to investment spending. We need spending if we want to create jobs. If money is put into savings, the job of the capital market, people like Mike who just called in, it's their job to find profitable outlets to invest that money. There's all sorts of investment projects that are attractive in this country. If we gradually shift our income from consumption to investment, we simultaneously make ourselves more productive so we can make more income. And the very act of building the machines and the other investment goods creates jobs that are every bit as valuable as the jobs we create when we build wings on mansions.
We have a few minutes left with Robert H. Frank, economist at Cornell, author of Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Helps the How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. He also wrote a previous book with now the Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke, and we're going to ask him about him in just a minute. But Bob in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bob.
Thank you. Professor Frank, under your
yes.
consumption tax plan, would you have an exemption for spending on basic necessities, such as an individual who buys their own health insurance and also home heating oil for a small home? And as far as income tax, if there's no tax on savings, would that include a lot of middle-class people have a modest income from, say, a modest mutual fund or some savings bonds? So if there's no tax on income, would you include a modest interest or dividend? Mm.
Also, is the interest or investment gain on your savings taxed as income or tax-exempt as savings?
What's taxed is the difference between your income, which would include any interest you earn or dividends you get on money you have invested. It's the difference between your income and how much you added to your savings account this year.
Mm-hmm.
So your annual income minus your annual savings. So you could talk about deductions for this or that. My strong preference would be to have a very large standard deduction rather than open up the legislative process for people to argue about which product should be exempt, which special category should be exempt. Just throw in a $30,000 exemption for a family of four and say that covers everything.
You wrote a textbook, Principles of Economics, with the current Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke. Do you know his views on the kind of tax plan that you're proposing?
It's not his job description to comment on tax policy. He's really the monetary side of it.
Oh, I
know
never
a little
stopped
bit about
Alan Greenspan.
It didn't, and one might say, would that it had stopped him.
Right.
He was commenting on the administration's policy of giving large tax relief to upper-income citizens and saying that to be able to pay for that, we have to cut back on Social Security benefits in the future. That was not part of the Fed chairman's job description to be making such comments.
Do you know Bernanke well?
The current Fed chairman doesn't make such comments.
And you think that's a good thing. Yeah. Do you know Ben Bernanke well?
I know him just as a co-author, but I'm very fond of him. I think he's a terrific person, a man of an incredibly high integrity and ability, an uncharacteristically outstanding appointment.
Other than not commenting on proposed tax cuts, do you see him as being better or worse or just substantively different in his approach to the economy than Greenspan in any particular ways?
Well, they're two different people, obviously. Ben Bernanke is probably the world's reigning expert on monetary policy as managed by central banks around the world. There's nobody who knows more about the minutiae and the intricacies of monetary policy than he does. Alan Greenspan didn't have that kind of academic background. He instead was a man of Wall Street. And so I think the natural backgrounds of the two men do point them in different directions when a crisis comes along. But we'll see how it unfolds. Yeah, this is Ben's first crisis. He seems to be holding up real well, just from all I've been able to tell.
We have about a minute left, and not to confuse the listeners, but you actually have two current books out. We've been talking primarily about the one called Falling Behind. There's also The Economic Naturalist. I see that you lectured at Google about that book recently, and the lecture is posted on YouTube, and listeners can follow the links that we've placed on our website to get there eventually. But it's about how economics is taught in colleges. So very briefly before you go, what's the problem as you see it with the way economics is taught today?
Well, we've got evidence now, Brian, that when students take an economics course as traditionally taught, 6 months later, they can't answer basic economics questions any better than people who never took the course. Boy, I wish I had time to expand on it. I will say that it's possible for economics to be incredibly interesting and fun for students. You mentioned the Google lecture. I've been delighted that the Google, they have an author series. They do a nice video of your lecture, you know, a lot of prominent authors. Nobody's heard of me, but there are all these famous authors in the lecture series. But the lecture I gave on economics is the highest rated lecture in the series. They sort them by ratings, any other category you want.
Well,
economics isn't supposed to be fun, but you really can make it fun if you focus it on how it applies in examples that occur around you every day.
So you think that's the nub of it, is just making it practical and relevant rather than theoretical and abstract?
Yeah, equations and graphs aren't the way to get ideas into freshmen's heads. It's not a good strategy, and that's mainly what the course has become. If you can teach people to pose and answer interesting questions with economic principles, then they're off and running. They learn how to do it on their own. They practice it. Why are there braille dots on the keypads of the drive-up ATM machines?
And would you rather live in a 4,000-square-foot house when others live in a 6,000, et cetera, et cetera?
And sure. If you pose interesting questions, you're going to want to know the answers to them, and then you're going to want to talk about them with your friends. It's really like learning to speak a new language. And I think if people will take that approach as opposed to the more narrow technical approach, then students will have a whole different relationship with the subject.
And I guess that's why you use New Yorker-like cartoons to illustrate some of the points in your book. I've been speaking with Robert H. Frank, economics professor at Cornell University, mostly about his book Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class, also the author of The Economic Naturalist, In Search of Explanations for Everyday Enigmas. Thanks so much for joining us. It's been really fascinating.
Yeah, thanks so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, a call-in on the question, should Larry Craig really resign? That's now in some depth. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692.